Hello, this is Elodie Reed, digital producer for Vermont Public Radio. This podcast has been edited for brevity and clarity. Yay!
This is Vermont Edition. I'm Bob Kinzel. Governor Phil Scott this week unveiled his budget proposal for the next fiscal year. Scott identified Vermont's growing demographic challenge as a crisis that needs a multi-pronged approach to this issue. It's a situation where the overall population of the state is projected to decrease over the next decade, while at the same time the number of people over 65 is increasing by 50%. The governor says he's hopeful that solutions can be found.
While there's no easy answer, no simple solution, no single idea that can completely stop the rolling consequences of our demographics, we are not helpless if we accept the challenge, set clearer objectives, have the discipline to commit to solutions, and follow through. We can reverse these trends.
In standard time. What is the governor proposing, and what's the legislative reaction to these proposals, and do lawmakers have their own agenda for these issues? Today, we've got a great panel of reporters to look at these and many other issues. With us today, Anne Wallace Allen, who is the business reporter at VT Digger, Paul Heintz of 7 Days, and VPR's Pete Hirschfeld. Great to have you all here today. Thanks for coming by.
Thanks for having us, Bob.
So let's just take a quick look at the governor's budget plan. It increases budget spending in the general fund by just under 3%. It doesn't raise any taxes or fees for Vermonters. It allocates $3 million for electric vehicle subsidies and new charging stations. It provides tax exemptions for nursing graduates who stay in the state. It appropriates an additional $3 million for childcare subsidies by allowing sports betting in Vermont and the licensing of keno games for bars and restaurants. And it also includes $3 million in cash payouts to larger businesses. These are businesses with more than 100 employees that make capital investments of at least $20 million. Scott says it's very important for the state to put a special focus on these larger companies.
To recognize the incredible importance of our larger anchor employers, the cornerstones of our regional economies, I propose a $3 million Vermont Capital Investment Incentive Program, which encourages these companies to make new upgrades at local facilities, and in exchange for the incentives, they'll commit to maintain certain payroll levels.
And you have a good sense of what Vermont companies need to do to stay in business, expand, hire more people. What are you hearing about this proposal? How effective might it be?
Well, Vermont already has a pretty robust program called Veggie that gives cash grants to companies that want to expand. And it's also got a training program that pays companies a lot of money to train their employees. And to get the money for these companies, to get the money from the state, the companies have to meet certain guidelines. And they actually come under a lot of criticism from people like the state auditor, Doug Hoffer, who says there's no way of measuring whether these actually pay off in real tax dollars back to the state, or whether the company in some cases would have stuck around anyway, whether or not it got this incentive. However, the governor's decided to forge ahead with a new program because he says there are large companies that need to make capital investments and they're being enticed by people in other states, by governments in other states, to give them money. A good example is the Energizer plant. You know, that they announced in the fall that they're going to close up shop and leave Bennington, and that's going to be 100 jobs that they're losing. And the Scott administration feels that if Energizer had been able to make capital investments along the way instead of making them in Wisconsin, where their headquarters are, they might have decided to stay and not mothball that plant.
And Paul, what I've heard from some of the Democratic leaders at the State House is they think that Governor Scott did a pretty good job explaining what the problem is, this demographic crisis, a lower workforce, large number of people over 65 in the next decade. But the sense they have is there's nothing really bold here. What kind of reaction have you heard at the State House?
I think that's right. I think State House leaders sort of held back initially after the after Scott delivered his budget address. They wanted to dig into some of the details because sometimes it's actually pretty difficult to find out what's really in the budget just from listening to that one speech. But yeah, I think the consensus from people around the State House is that there's not much in here that is truly offensive to Democrats, but there's also nothing in there that's super inspiring to really anybody. You know, I mean, this is a lot – this is sort of a grab bag budget with, you know, a few million here for this, a few million for that. But there wasn't really a real thematic unity to what the governor has proposed here. And so, you know, I think it's kind of – it's a little bit more typical of what you see in the second year of a biennium when a governor is heading into reelection. They don't necessarily want to provoke as much as they would in a non-election year. So that might be part of what's happening here. It's also not a real austerity budget. So you're not seeing Democrats and progressives going totally like freaking out about this in any way.
And do you think the governor is hemmed in a little bit because he doesn't have any tax increases or fee increases, so he doesn't have a lot of money to work with?
Yeah, definitely. And you know, last year he did propose a couple of tax increases for the first time. This year, there are no increases to existing taxes or fees, but he is proposing, as you mentioned, expanding some gambling programs, and that would come with new revenue, which he would use for part of it would go to child care subsidies.
Well, let's take a look at that gambling proposal. The governor did propose an additional $3 million for child care subsidies. Probably a very popular plan, but he wants to pay for it by increasing gambling in the state in the form of sports betting and the legalization of Keno. Here's what he said in his budget speech.
Let's build on this success with an additional $3 million for child care assistance. And let's also expand the lottery and commit these new revenues to this initiative each year moving forward.
I'm going to guess, Pete, there's a fair amount of support for more money for child care subsidies up at the State House. But what are you hearing about this funding source, sports betting and Keno? How's that going over?
You know, you don't have to look too far back into Vermont's history to see how complicated and controversial the issue of expanding state-sanctioned gambling in Vermont is. I can recall 2015, I believe it was, when the Lottery Commission under then-Governor Peter Shumlin decided they wanted to buy 25 scratch-off lotto ticket vending machines and put them in bars where they thought they would sell much more, take many more tickets, generate a lot more revenue. When House lawmakers caught wind of this, they were appalled. They thought it was totally inappropriate to put these things in places where people's capacities may be a little diminished by whatever they've been having at the bar. Anyhow, those machines ended up getting mothballed, and I think that's reflective of the sentiment that the House brings to this issue now. House Speaker Mitzi Johnson said as much during a press conference after the governor's budget. There are a lot of folks in that chamber that just don't like the idea of making even more gambling opportunities available to Vermonters, so I think it's going to run into some real opposition.
Now, the governor was asked, or his staff was asked about that at the budget briefing, and they said, hey, we already have a lottery, right? So this is not a big step. This is just a slight expansion of what we're already doing.
Well, what's interesting is that Governor Phil Scott himself just a couple years ago was making a much different case. The issue of online sports betting has been around perennially now since it came into existence. The idea was floated that Vermont should perhaps embrace this, sanction it, generate revenue if people are betting on sports games already anyway. He didn't think it was such a great idea. His position is obviously evolved. I'm not sure that the majority of the legislature has caught up with him yet. Though I should mention there have been several bills introduced in the legislature that would legalize online sports betting, fantasy sports specifically. So there is some purchase for the idea. The question is whether or not enough folks are going to be comfortable with that for it to move forward.
And there was a time a couple of years ago people were talking about casinos in Vermont. There was going to be a casino up in Stowe. And there's some people at the State House who say this is a very slippery slope. We're going from the lottery to sports betting, and who knows exactly what that entails. are casinos around the corner.
I think in Vermont, it is seen as an extremely regressive tax on the poor. I mean, study after study shows that it is poor people who stand to lose the most from gambling. And I have never seen any enthusiasm for that. Just it's sort of like the heart of Vermont is against this kind of revenue stream. I can see why it is happening now, because nobody has the will or the desire to cut any of the very popular programs, and the state obviously needs more money to pay for them. And it's a nice way to sort of whitewash it by saying, but this would pay for childcare, so it's a good thing, just the way that you have gambling pay for schools. But I can't imagine them mustering enough support to get something like this through.
And Paul, I can hear the governor saying, well, if you don't like this revenue source, if you don't like sports betting, come up with your own idea, but don't raise any taxes.
Right. So this is kind of the classic move you always see from governors, right, of any party. It's I'm going to balance my budget by proposing something that I know the legislature is not actually going to support. And then when they don't support it, it's up to them to figure out how to fill that hole. So it's kind of a classic move. It usually works. One interesting thing about this question, I think, is that in the Senate, at least, I'm starting to hear some arguments similar to what you hear around cannabis, which is it's cannabis legalization. It's happening everywhere. It's happening all around us. So we might as well get in on the action. And so that's certainly true with online sports betting. It's true a bit with Keno as well. I'll be curious to see how that argument plays out, whether that will smooth the passage a little bit more. But, I agree that it's unlikely to see the light of day.
Let's talk to Skip in South Royalton. Hey, Skip, welcome to the program.
Oh, thanks for taking my call. My comments are generally consistent with what I've heard people say so far on the program today. If this is a crisis, this Democratic a demographic challenge is a crisis, then you need a response that's equal to that crisis. And I feel that the governor's budget would be really good for the business roundtable, but it's really nibbling around the edges. It's not really squaring off. You want to expand the number of Vermonters, then ask yourself how to bring them in. I think that refugee resettlement is one way. I would think that universal pre-K daycare would be another way. You want young families to come in to towns. You want them to buy the old house, fix it up. You want them to run for school board. You want them to coach soccer. Attract young families. Labor is a big part of an economy, and stop going to businesses and relaxing standards and giving them tax breaks. It's not the whole picture, and we know these trickle-down things just don't work.
Skip, thanks very much for your phone call. We got this email from Elizabeth regarding the sports betting idea. I find Governor Scott's proposal to allow Keno and sports gambling in Vermont alarming. The mafia is often involved, which is also alarming. This seems like a trade that will alter the landscape of Vermont forever. I lived in Reno in the late 1970s and saw firsthand what can happen when slot machines, Keno, and betting were in every eatery, bar, and gas station. They took over. This would destroy what makes Vermont so special. We need to stand up to this. So there's probably, as Paul, as you mentioned, there's going to be a little tension over sports betting at the Statehouse.
Yeah, and just to respond actually to something that Skip was saying, you know, the governor did mention in his address wanting to bring more legal immigrants to the state. He talked about recruiting new Americans here, and some have said that could be an answer to the demographic challenge. But then if you actually look at the budget that he proposed, he really actually only suggested putting another $150,000 into those programs. So, in the budget address itself, he got probably the biggest applause line of the day from talking about the importance of supporting new Americans and bringing them to Vermont. But when you really look at what he's proposing, there's not a lot of money there.
Well, as you mentioned, he did get a lot of applause, a standing ovation on Tuesday afternoon when he said that. And he was quite adamant about this possibility.
These efforts not only benefit our state, they also signal we're committed to the values this nation was built on, that America is still a land of opportunity for all who seek freedom from oppression, security for their families, or in some cases, just a fresh start. As long as I'm governor, They'll be welcome here in Vermont.
Governor Phil Scott at his budget address on Tuesday afternoon. And another component of this idea of the demographic challenge is affordable housing.
That's right. And there's a group of lawmakers for whom this is the number one issue when it comes to demographics. They say that people can't move into the state because they can't find a place to live, especially in Chittenden County. But in central Vermont, too, people have said that. And to these lawmakers, it's a chicken and an egg thing. If the state says, or the state treasurer and the governor both say, well, we can't afford another housing bond because we just don't have that kind of debt capacity, lawmakers like Senator Michael Surratt can say, but if we could just pay for this housing, employers would be able to attract better people, and those people would come and work, and we would have more tax revenues, and it would boost the whole economy. It doesn't look like it's going to happen this year. The treasurer has been pretty clear that the state just doesn't have that kind of lending ability. But the one thing that hasn't come up a lot in the conversation in the State House is that most other states are struggling with exactly the same problems. It's kind of a structural problem in the economy of building houses. In Vermont, it's exacerbated by Act 250, which has created some incentives and disincentives for building housing in a way that makes it affordable in places where it's needed.
Well, Paul, the governor says his major effort to deal with climate change is to take steps to lower carbon emissions in Vermont's transportation sector. He wants to allocate about $3 million for additional electric vehicle subsidies and additional charging stations. He's targeting the transportation sector because he says it's responsible for between 50 and 60% of the state's total carbon emissions. What's been the reaction to the governor's plan?
It has definitely been a very tepid one from Democrats and progressives in the House. They say, and they said this after his State of the State address a couple weeks ago, that when we saw some pretty intense protests from climate activists, they say that he is perhaps recognizing the problem, or at least saying he's recognizing the problem, but he's not actually doing anything about it. These are pretty small incremental measures, and the governor has continued to make the point that he's not going to support anything that's going to increase energy costs on Vermonters. So I think that's going to be a real point of tension this session. Legislators are feeling the heat. Democratic and progressive legislators are feeling the heat on this one. I think they want to deliver something, but you know, Scott is pretty much sticking to more money for EVs.
Now, Pete, there's a proposal up at the State House. I believe it's called the Transportation Climate Initiative. It goes by TCI. Is that correct?
Yep.
I think it asks wholesalers of gasoline and diesel fuels to have a carbon offset for the fuels that they bring into the state, which they say they're going to have to pass along to consumers. So in one form or another will be a carbon tax. What's the likelihood that lawmakers will adopt this approach?
Well, I should note that there are some people that would say there is a fundamental difference between the Transportation and Climate Initiative and a carbon tax, because it creates different ways for folks to address this new market force of an increased cost for gas by doing things to avoid that increased cost, i.e. using less fossil fuels. That distinction notwithstanding, you know, the governor's made very clear that he is not going to support the Transportation and Climate Initiative because it is projected to have an increase on the cost of gasoline and diesel, on-road diesel. The computer modeling suggests anywhere between 5 cents to 29 cents a gallon over the course of the next 10 years, depending on whether lawmakers want to reduce greenhouse gas emissions by 20% or 25%. Phil Scott, it should be noted, is not the only person who has concerns about this. And some of the people who share his concerns are some of the people who are most vocally supportive of reducing greenhouse gas emissions. There's a sense that this could be regressive, that this could hit low-income folks the most. And so we're seeing a number of proposals to sort of offset that by raising taxes on wealthy folks. And there's a belief that even among people that want to see the price of gas go up as a means of reducing the amount of fossil fuels that people are using, that if you're going to do that, you've got to figure out some way to blunt the impact on people who won't be able to well afford it.
And Ann, do you have a sense if the business community, A, thinks something needs to be done rather dramatically, and if they do, are we going to go to a carbon tax? Or are we going to go to taxing wealthy Vermonters, as Pete mentioned, that Senator Polina has a plan on? How does this filtering out that way?
They've shown unqualified lack of enthusiasm for anything that is going to raise their cost of doing business when it comes to the TCI. So, and they've been pretty vocal about that with the Scott administration. A lot of the people who are in the larger companies are also among the wealthy 10%. So that would direct them affect them directly. But I think that in general, the businesses that have a strong mission towards social responsibility and who talk about that a lot and who identify themselves with that, this is an area where they're being very, very cautious because they know that it would cost them a lot, most of the manufacturing businesses especially, and that they like to have they need to have a predictable expectation for what their cost's going to be over the coming years. And this also makes it difficult for them to support. So I haven't seen much enthusiasm for anything that would raise prices when it comes to that.
It almost feels like as we're watching politics evolve in recent years, climate has become this central issue that everybody is now talking about. But it almost seems to have become like the new affordability as a term, where everybody uses the word, but that doesn't necessarily signal a willingness to move forward on that issue in a way that the people who care about climate action want to see. So it's just fascinating. I mean, you see a guy like Phil Scott, who is perceived as by people who care most about climate action, dedicating a significant portion of his budget address to the issue of the climate, and yet that doesn't necessarily mean that saying that word and vowing to make it a priority necessarily means anything to the people that care about it.
And just to piggyback on that a little bit, I mean, it wasn't so long ago. I think it was when Governor Scott was first running for governor in the 2016 election that he said he expressed publicly some skepticism of the science behind climate change. He walked that back fairly quickly. But, you know, he's come a long way rhetorically since then. But I think his opponents would say he's not come a long way substantively.
And you know, another thing that I've seen with the businesses is that they are taking this in their own hands to undertake as many retrofits as possible to make their own operation as efficient as possible so that whatever happens, they can lower their costs just the way that they would try to lower their costs with anything else.
And Paul, do you have a sense whether or not the Democratic leaders at the State House, Senate President Pro Tem Tim Ash or House Speaker Mitzi Johnson, do they really want a roll call vote this session on some sort of carbon tax?
Probably not. I mean, I confess I haven't been following this super closely so far this session, but I haven't really gotten the sense that legislative leaders have a real organized plan around this. And that's what you need if you're going to get something this tough done. And, you know, it feels a little bit to me like what we saw last year with paid family leave and minimum wage, which is a lot of talk about it, but not a real plan that seems likely to succeed. So they, you know, by talking about it as much as they are doing, they may be setting themselves up for failure as well, especially in the eyes of climate activists.
And Pete, you raised a really good point. I think that a lot of people will identify climate change as the number one issue facing this legislature this year. But then if you dig a little bit beneath that, what do people mean? What do they think are solutions? There's really no majority support around any particular plan.
There's not. I mean, I think, you know, there has been some organization in the House around this piece of legislation called the Global Warming Solutions Act. And this would require Vermont to reduce its greenhouse emissions by, I'm forgetting the exact number, but 28% by 2025. I think a lot of politicians understand that more and more people care viscerally about climate change and what it's going to mean for them and their children and their grandchildren. What if what elected officials don't have as good a bead on right now is what are people willing to trade for those carbon emission reductions, right? Are they willing to pay an extra 50 cents a gallon for gas? Are they willing to pay an extra $2 a gallon for gas? Are they willing to pay more to heat their homes? Are they willing to drive less? Are they willing to abide new public policies that compel them to change their behavior in ways that may impact their quality of life? And Phil Scott, I imagine, has a very different answer to that question than David Zuckerman, say. So it's just going to be interesting to watch elected officials and prospective elected officials try to tease out the will of the electorate when it comes to what are they really willing to do to get to these emission reductions.
Let's go back to our callers and talk to Rob, who's calling from South Lincoln. Hey, Rob, welcome to the program.
Hi, Bob. Great panel. Thanks for taking my call. One piece, this is going to circle back to more of the beginning of the program, is looking at our quote-unquote demographic crisis. There's incredible research out there from Iowa State University looking at the state of Iowa, which is dealing with a similar demographic challenge, and what they're trying to do to basically shrink smart. Say, you know what, maybe tomorrow 100 people aren't going to, you know, move into town, or 100 babies aren't going to get born. So what are we doing as we get older and we don't gain population to continue to improve on the quality of our life? I would love to see the governor and our legislators sort of maybe look into that research a little bit, and other local Vermonters also. And not to sound morbid, but, you know, less people behaving the same way actually does influence the trajectory of our greenhouse gas emissions. I know that's not the answer people necessarily want to hear, but just putting that on the table. Thanks so much.
So, Rob, can I ask you a quick question?
Yeah, go ahead,
because
Bob.
You feel it sounds like you're familiar with the Iowa research. Is there an acknowledgement in Iowa that the population is not going to grow, so their decision makers are trying to cope with that reality, as opposed to in Vermont, we're still looking for ways to increase the population so that we can maintain the services we have?
Yeah, I mean, it looks at communities that are just sort of acknowledging that, hey, you know, most Americans right now, where they're moving, tend to be in urban places, not rural areas. And so if that's just the case, and that's our foreseeable future, how do we strengthen our communities? How do we help each other out to improve the quality of life, not just say, hey, you know, the quality of life as we get older, as less and less people live in our communities, is going to actually diminish. It's trying to flip that on its head.
Rob, thanks very much for your phone call. It's a very interesting observation of what's going on out in Iowa. Let's turn to Jesse, who's calling from Fletcher. Hey, Jesse, welcome to the program.
Hi there, Bob. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I was just going to speak briefly to the earlier topic around the demographic issue in Vermont. And just want to say, I work a lot around the country, and I have colleagues around the country and internationally. And one of the big issues Vermont has is an image issue, especially with young people. And it has a lot to do with how Vermont in general deals with issues around diversity and racism. And I think racism and diversity is often something talked about in Vermont like it's a special interest group issue or a social justice issue. And I would add that, especially for young people today, I think it actually affects Vermont's issues around economics and economy and demographics, attracting young people to the state. There's just quite, you know, to put it simply, Vermont's behind on this, and people around the country in general have a perception of Vermont as being, you know, a place which is very friendly for white people, but not so much for people of color. And I think there's a lot we can do to bring more attention, you know, through legislative action and through how it's talked about in Vermont, to make it a friendlier environment and really let people around the country, young people, know that Vermont has actually progressed on this issue. And I know there's a lot of initiatives in the House right now, potential House bills that could address this, but I notice that it's, you know, this is an ongoing thing, and this does affect very, very significantly the young people who are leaving Vermont.
All right, Jesse, you raised a very important point. Pete?
I'm reminded, listening to Jesse, of a report that Vermont's Director of Racial Equity, it's a newly created position held by Susanna Davis, who's been there for a few months now. She submitted a report to the legislature sort of detailing some early findings that she's encountered over the course of her work. And she said one of the biggest stumbling blocks that Vermont faces right now is that white people in this state don't see that they have any real stake in conversations around racial equity. They're unable to see why they personally would benefit, why their communities would benefit, why this is something that they are – that their fates are tied to in a meaningful way. And she says in this brief that she sent to the legislature that that's something that the state is really going to have to work on. If it wants to get buy-in for some of these racial justice and racial equity initiatives that some lawmakers are trying to move forward, that many communities in the state are trying to move forward to, then people here have to understand that this is an issue that affects not just people of color in this state, but something that we all as a state have a vested interest in.
The House yesterday voted in favor of a compromise paid family leave bill. The vote was 89 to 58. Legislation calls for 12 weeks of paid leave time when a child is born and 8 weeks to care for a sick family member. Individuals would also have the option of signing up for a plan to have paid leave in the event that they get sick. Most Democrats voted for it. Most Republicans opposed it. And in somewhat of a surprise, the leader of the Progressive Caucus, Middletown Springs Representative Robin Chestnut Tangerman, told his colleagues that he would vote no because the compromise does not go far enough to provide critical benefits for workers.
It gives me no pleasure to do so, but I rise in opposition to this bill. And I oppose this bill not because it goes too far, but because it does not go far enough. It's not just a personal benefit. It's a societal benefit. And we as a whole benefit when we care for each other.
The Senate has already passed this bill, so now it goes to the governor for his review. It's very likely that he's going to veto it. Pete, there seems to be enough votes in the Senate to override a gubernatorial veto, but the situation in the House is a little more confused because what are the progressives going to do who voted against the bill yesterday?
Well, that's an open question. I think there's an open question as to whether even if some of the people who support paid leave in concept do change their votes for a veto override vote, it's not really clear that House lawmakers are going to be able to get that supermajority. There were 8 votes against the legislation in the final floor vote. That means that House leaders are going to need to turn 8 people. They're going to have to convince 8 people who voted no on the bill on Thursday to vote yes on the bill if and when that veto override vote comes up. Now, there are 5 progressives who would be good candidates to work on. I talked to one of them, Representative Selena Coburn, who said, look, I'm voting no on this bill right now. That doesn't mean I'm committed to voting against an override. That's a different vote for a different day with different considerations. So there's hope of bringing them on board. I know there's at least one Democrat who voted against it but who supports paid leave in concept. Maybe he's somebody they can work on, but they still need to get 2 more. And I'm not sure whether those votes exist right now or whether or not they can be compelled or convinced or enticed to vote the other way.
Putting it diplomatically.
And Democrats argue that this bill will help draw more young families to the state. Opponents say it's going to have the opposite effect because it'll make Vermont less affordable because it does include a payroll tax increase. This plan does put the entire burden for paying for this program on the employee. Now, yes, employers can contribute if they want to, but they don't have to. So given that reality, how big an issue is this for the state's business community?
It's a big issue. It's something that comes up a lot. I was at the Vermont Chamber's Economic Conference yesterday, and a lot of the people I talked to between sessions were talking about this and saying that, again, they simply can't afford to tack something on like this, even though it sounds like a good idea, and yes, it would help people. On the other hand, whenever you hear the cry, if you're having trouble finding employees, why don't you just pay them more? Businesses invariably respond that, well, there's other ways to attract people here. There's other ways to get employees engaged and get them to stay. And, you know, family leave would definitely be one of those things. But I don't see – I know that this, for the small employers, it's probably just out of the question. And for the larger ones, I don't see a lot of enthusiasm for it as a possibility, at least – maybe they see that in principle, the ones that belong to VBSR and who want to attain the goals that are set out by companies in VBSR. But in reality, they just think it would be highly unpopular with their workers, too, because it would cost too much.
Paul, another issue at the State House is raising the state minimum wage. The House voted on it this morning on a conference committee report that raises the minimum wage to $12.55 an hour over a two-year period. The vote in the House was 93-52. That's another one that faces a veto from Governor Scott. Is this another case where a veto override is very uncertain?
Yeah, I mean, it's certainly an open question. So one difference here is that the progressives in this instance voted for the minimum wage bill, even though this is far less than what they sought last year, which was $15 minimum wage over a slightly longer period of time. So it's interesting that they see this one differently. They're not being total purists on it. Nevertheless, even with their votes, as you said, there were 52 votes against this, and so that's not quite enough to overcome a veto. In the Senate, on both bills, paid family leave and minimum wage, there does appear to be a two-thirds majority, but we're really looking at the House here. One question that I have is whether the governor really would veto this minimum wage increase. You'll remember that in the budget address earlier this week, he specifically called out paid family leave as a no-go. He made no mention of minimum wage. And in a statement from his spokesperson today, he responding to this vote, he also did not rule out signing it or at least letting it go into law without his signature. So it is it's possible that the legislature will not need to override Governor Scott. Maybe he'll split the difference. He'll veto paid leave and he won't veto minimum wage. But I'm getting into the realm of speculation here, so I should probably be a little careful. We don't really know.
Let's talk to John, who's calling from Waterbury Center. Hey, John, welcome to the program.
Hi, thank you. I just had an observation. I'm one of the baby boomers that moved here 40 years ago, and I'm a senior, retired, and I'm one of the main population people here. And I moved here for the clean water, clean air. I took a vow of poverty, but I sacrificed that for the great environment. And it seems over the last 40 years, Act 250 has come under attack. The business sector seems to be the main priority now about getting business growth rather than keeping the water and air clean. I just don't see why people would want to move to this state with our water so dirty and our air not so clean anymore. And I just think that the environmental issues that we used to be concerned about just aren't being covered anymore. I don't even think that the governor mentioned anything about tourism or spending money on the environment to help clean it up. It's just an
okay, John. The governor did mention putting more money into tourism. I think he was looking at around $1 million for several different tourism programs, just to mention that. But, Pete, it raises Act 250, and it seems like there's some growing consensus at the State House, but that doesn't mean it's going to pass, that there ought to be some changes to Act 250 in regard to downtown areas.
Yeah, we're seeing some consensus around the need to ease or streamline the permitting process for commercial and residential developments in densely populated areas. This would be a city downtown or a village center in a community in Vermont. And the idea is if we make it easier there, then we're going to get development where we want it, which is where we already have infrastructure to support it, that we're going to avoid sprawl. But these are complicated deals to work out because Act 250 is a complicated piece of legislation. It's been around for almost 50 years. So while there is agreement in principle among some influential and key parties, there's still some distance that they're going to have to cover in order to come up with a proposal that that can pass muster.
And Paul, just to wrap up today's program, I wanted to look at the presidential race and Bernie Sanders. Interesting week for Bernie Sanders. Hillary Clinton said some very nasty things about him. Quote, nobody likes him. Nobody wants to work with him. It's all just baloney. It's not just him. It's the culture around him. Peter Shumlin, former Governor Shumlin, also who is supporting Joe Biden this year, also said some very negative things. That he said that Bernie doesn't really care about anybody except himself. And Madeleine Kunin was outraged that Bernie thinks that he's done more for women's rights than she has. Now, at the same time this is going on, we've got new polls in Iowa and New Hampshire showing Bernie doing quite well. So is this kind of beat up on the front runner?
Yeah, I think these two things are somewhat connected. Whenever you start doing pretty well, you get a target on your back. And it is undeniable that Senator Sanders is really surging at the perfect time going into the Iowa caucuses pretty soon. He just overtook Vice President Biden in a national poll for the first time yesterday. I think it was a CNN poll. He's doing quite well in New Hampshire. There's been a little bit less polling in Iowa recently, but he's doing well there. So, he is a candidate to watch. That means we're going to be hearing a lot more about Bernie Sanders in the 1970s in Vermont, in the 1980s in Vermont, things that he said in the past. But, you know, I have to say, especially when it comes to Hillary Clinton's remarks, I think that does nothing but helps him. I think that it that outrages his base. It gets his base working harder. I think sounds to a lot of people like sour grapes. If I'm Bernie Sanders, I relish that kind of confrontation. I think it does nothing but help.
Pete, we're almost out of time, but we've got Bernie Sanders and three other senators running for president who are stuck in Washington, D.C. right now with the impeachment trial. So kind of a tough time for them.
Not ideal timing. I mean, these guys may get these senators may get some news hits on NBC or national news. They're not going to get it where it matters, though. Cedar Rapids, Des Moines, places in Iowa, local news there. So he does have a strong fundraising apparatus. They have a lot of money, and so perhaps he can blunt the impact of not being there with some of the satellite offices they have across Iowa.
Be fascinating to see what happens. Iowa caucuses are a week from Monday night. This has been a great discussion of many of the issues at the State House. Many thanks to our panel today, Ann Wallace Allen of VT Digger, Paul Heitz of 7 Days, and VPR's Pete Hirschfeld. Thank you all very much for taking the time to come by and talk to us about these issues.
Thanks, Bob.